The darkness comes around noon, and the psychological abandonment that Jesus experiences, coupled with physical sensation as Jesus cries out, "I thirst." And we come to the sort of darkest point in the seven sayings of the cross. The next two have a different measure of hope. But in this one, again, there's this physical measure of pain here. And, you know, it's interesting because John is an artist, and he's wanting to call some things to mind here for us. And I know I'm about 20 years behind, but I'm not sure if you've heard of this new series of books, the Harry Potters. You guys heard of? Yeah, I've started reading those with the kids. We made it through book two yesterday, and the kids wanted to see the movie, so I let them watch the movie. Probably a mistake. Probably bad. I didn't care. I'm so tired of watching awful shows with them. So I'm like, yeah, let's watch the movie. And sure enough, 9 p.m., the kids are in bed, and I hear crying, and I go up. So he's like, "I'm scared of the snake." I'm like, yeah, this probably would happen. And, I don't know if you get this. I didn't do it, but there's like this cruel part of me that's like wanted to be like, "You mean the one under your bed?" Like, I don't know why. I have to fight them off. But anyways, everyone's crying. I get them settled. And then by the time I go to bed, though, I come to bed last night, all three of my kids are in bed. And I have to shimmy into this little space, put my little CPAP machine on there. And anyway, at 4:30 in the morning, I feel, and Evie's like, "Get out. You're taking up too much room." So I didn't sleep well last night. But the reason I bring up Harry Potter is what I've been amazed by, because I've never read the books, I'm reading them along with my kids, is how brilliantly she sets up things in the beginning of her book that come to play and come to fruition later in the book. There's so many things in the beginning that come full circle in the end, and this is exactly what the artist John is trying to do. His gospel is, again, it's more artistic memoir than it is history. And he sets up his book so that everything is interconnected. And there's two scenes early in the book of John that set up this later scene of Jesus on the cross in thirst. And they're the stories of the woman at the well and Jesus turning water into wine. And what both of these stories speak to is, in John's art piece here, is water, human need, wine, and most importantly, they speak of kindness. In the woman of the well story, of course, Jesus is traveling through Samaria, which was the about the equivalent of someone from Israel traveling through Palestine today. There's some tribal tensions going on there. So Jesus, not an us versus them kind of guy. He's traveling through Samaria, and it's a hot day. It's around noon. He's weary. He's tired. So he stops at a well, and Jesus' disciples, they head out into town trying to find some food. They're weary and tired. And Jesus is alone at the well, and along comes a woman. And she comes to the well at noon, which is a cue to us, because we know that what this means is that she's marginalized even from within her own marginalized group. From what I'm told, in most cultures that have to retrieve water as a daily habit, you would go to the well in morning or evening to avoid the heat of the day. And so the fact that she's there at noon means she's trying to avoid people. She doesn't want to interact with the other Samaritans, and that's because she's a woman of sketchy reputation. And Jesus is there at the well and asks her for a drink. And what unfolds in this story is an interaction of tender kindness as Jesus speaks into her life and heals her. And if you've been tracking with us this season, you will know from earlier in the year, Jesus' healings were not just sort of these isolated physical miracles. When Jesus heals, it's a holistic social interaction. Jesus repairs social bonds when he heals. He restores relationships. And that's exactly what he does with this woman. He offers her living water. And in that, he restores this woman to her community. He brings her back into harmony with a community she's been isolated from. And because of that, the whole town comes to believe that Jesus is, in fact, Savior of the world. And it's a powerful story because Jesus asks for a drink, and in return, he gives this town the living water of a restored community. And I think what the story does is it highlights for us the kindness of God, the kindness of God that is always looking to restore that which is broken and estranged. And then the second story that Jesus' crucifixion scene calls to mind is, of course, the earliest story of Jesus in the Gospel of John, Jesus turning water into wine. And there's a wedding. And in those days, weddings weren't a one-day affair. It was like a long weekend celebration. You go at it. And so you had to do some calculations if you're hosting. If I got 150 people coming and I got to feed and give them drink for 3-4 days, you got to do the math. But somewhere along the line, somebody's math had broken down. They didn't have enough wine. They've run out of wine. Calculated wrong how much they needed. And so in the middle of the wedding celebration, the one thing you don't want is to run out of food or wine, and that's exactly what happens. I mean, this would have been so embarrassing. This was a social faux pas of the highest order. This would have made them look like a fool. Have you ever looked like a fool? Of course you have. I suppose you're wondering if I've ever looked like a fool. I know that might be hard to believe, but it's happened on occasion. I remember I was going into Food Basics, doing some shopping at Food Basics one time. This is a number of years ago. And on my way in, I got stopped by two kids. They said, "Hey, mister, can we take a picture of you?" Why? They said, "Well, we're trying to get pictures of the coolest men we've seen today." Well, said, "You've come to the right place." I said, "Sure, you've got exquisite taste. What do you need? What kind of pose do you want from me?" It's like, let's try a few things, and then just kind of, it gets weird, right? Like, what do? Just sort of look at them like this. I've got the glasses down, or like this. So, and they're like, "That's almost right. Can you just get a little bit closer?" And they're coming in close to my face. They're like, "Ready?" And then they clicked a button to take a picture, and it was like a gimmick camera. They held it down, and water squirted out all over my face and shirt. And then they started laughing and ran away like jackals. And I was just looking like a fool. They had built me up. I thought I was all that. And then to be sprayed with water was embarrassing. I'm grocery shopping wet. It's just, oh my goodness. I look like a complete fool. And you know, the interesting thing to me about this story of Jesus is when we think of world issues and problems that could be fixed in the world, fixing moments of humiliation and looking foolish are probably pretty low on the pecking order. But what I love about this scene, the wedding, is Jesus' kindness towards those who are humiliated. And Jesus responds to humiliation with a deep kindness that goes beyond just kindness, because what he does is he changes water into wine. And so it's not just that he rescues this couple from humiliation. He actually gives them something to brag about, because we read that the wine, this is the best wine. And normally, of course, you serve the best wine till people are sufficiently liquored up to not know the difference, and then people can't tell if it's an $8 bottle of wine, 20, doesn't matter. But no, they've saved the best wine to last. And so this couple move from humiliation to being covered in kindness to having something to celebrate and be proud of. And I think what John wants is for us to have these stories lingering in our mind as we come to the crucifixion scene. Jesus takes an embarrassing moment, and through an act of kindness, he transforms this couple's shame and humiliation into celebration and honor. And these stories of water and wine and human need and thirst and the kindness of God, they're supposed to be sort of etched into our minds, hanging on the walls of our minds, because we know everything's connected in John's gospel as we come to Jesus' fifth word from the cross. And it plays out this way. Later, knowing that everything had now been finished and so that scripture would be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I am thirsty." A jar of wine vinegar was there. So they soaked a sponge in it, put the sponge on a stalk of the hyssop plant, and lifted it to Jesus' lips. Here, Jesus is thirsty. And in this moment, we see the most basic of human needs in Jesus: water. I need water. There's no need, no desire that's more basic and primal than our need for water. I'm told our human body is more than 60% water. Our blood is 92% water. Our muscles are 75% water. Even our bones are 22% water. A human can survive, apparently, for more than a month without food, but can't make it 3 days without water, and that's under good conditions. And the cruelty of the cross, of course, was expediting this process. Jesus is bleeding out. He needs water. He's thirsty. He's beaten, scourged. His body's torn open. The cross is quite literally draining the life from him. And he's losing the very essence of life as he bleeds out. And in this moment, he expresses the most basic human need. Water. And there's once again echoes here of Psalm 22. I don't know if you've ever had a hard time in your life and a song sort of resonates with you, but it's very clear from what we read of the crucifixion account that Psalm 22 was lingering in Jesus' mind as he's dying on the cross. There's an echo of this in Psalm 22. It says there, "I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It is melted within me. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death." Excuse me. And so dying early in the cross, we see Jesus focusing on others, forgiveness, compassion, mercy, kindness. But as the dark reality of the cross descends upon him, he feels not only psychologically abandoned, but all he can think of is the primal human need for water. And so he cries out for just one act of mercy. "I thirst." Just, please, one act of mercy in an ocean of cruelty. "Please, some water, I thirst." But his request is answered with cruelty, not kindness. And I mean, there could be no doubt that there was water at the scene. Sometimes crucifixion, they took days. And so there's no way there was not a Roman soldier without water at the scene. No one goes on a possibly 2-3 day long journey without taking water with them. But no water for Jesus, no. On the side, there's a jar of sour wine, something that would be akin to us as vinegar. And so they soak a sponge in vinegar and raise it to Jesus' lips. His ask for one small act of mercy is answered with cruelty. And it's hard to, vinegar is an interesting thing. I remember I was going to do it this year because April Fool's Day was this year, and I was going to do it to my family, but I thought better of it. But my mom did this to my brother one April Fool's Day. He came in from playing outside, and he was thirsty, and she poured him a glass of vinegar, and he took that and just, he was very, because it's just revolting. And so I've asked Calvin if he would come and join me here for a shot of vinegar. Because I thought, let's see how this goes. You take the bigger one, I think that's better. Yeah, you take the bigger one. What? Is mine vinegar?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's vinegar. All right. I'm nervous about this. All right, you ready?
Yeah.
Cheers. 1, 2, 3. I don't know if I should have done that. I should have let you do that. What was that experience?
It's still going. It's awful.
Burning?
Yeah.
Burning.
Right here.
I hear you. Actually, I need a little bit. I just need a sip here. Anyway, thank you for being brave enough to do that. Okay. Let's hope I make it through here. Vinegar burns. It's not refreshing at all. And so what is fascinating to me about this scene is it's one small detail. One small detail in the story. The entire crucifixion scene is one of cruelty. Crucifixion itself was, of course, creatively designed to enact cruelty in every possible way. The English word excruciating comes out of the idea of crucifixion. And On top of this world and ocean of cruelty that's playing out, there sits this one little act of cruelty. And I think what John is trying to do here is create a picture and a portrait for us. And I think the idea playing out here is this: where Jesus gives out the best wine of human kindness, he's given the sour wine of human cruelty. Whereas Jesus gives out the extravagant kindness of living water that restores communities, Jesus is given only vinegar. And on the cross, Jesus drinks the sour wine of human cruelty. And as we move towards Easter, continue our journey towards Easter, and as we consider Jesus' work on the cross, one of the things I've come to think is that, you know, we've talked about a lot of things with the cross, but whatever else Jesus was doing and accomplishing on the cross, of this I am sure, on the cross, Jesus drinks the sour wine of human cruelty in order to save us from our addiction to human cruelty. In short, cruelty is about taking pleasure in bringing pain and suffering on others. And I think here's the truth: we humans are cruel, all of us. One of the most lamentable aspects of humanity is our capacity as humans to be creatively cruel. Other animals kill, other animals even torment for a time, but there is no species in the history of the universe that has been so spectacularly and creatively cruel as we are. From the horrors of torture, all the way to the little things like how we employ humor and gossip and even silence, humans are creatively cruel. And it's not just a human capacity. I would say it's a human addiction. We're addicted to cruelty. We just can't help ourselves. But why? Well, of course, for a long time, we have explained cruelty in the world through the lens of dehumanization. David Livingston Smith, his book, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, he argues that cruelty is what happens when one fails to appreciate the humanity of others. And there can be no question that this is at least part of the equation. Examples are way too easy to find in history. Dehumanizing others seems to explain a lot when it comes to human cruelty. And when it does, the fix for it seems, well, relatively simple in some regards. Educate people, teach people to see everyone as human. But the problem with thinking the dehumanization explains it all is that many are talking about today how it's just but one part of the equation. Paul Bloom, he's a professor at Yale, he argues that most of the time we are cruel actually for the complete opposite reason. Not because we don't see others as human, but because we see them as precisely human. He says this: a lot of people blame cruelty on dehumanization. They say that when you fail to appreciate the humanity of other people, that's where genocide and slavery and all sorts of evil come from, but I don't think that's entirely wrong, but it's incomplete. A lot of the cruelty we do to one another, the real savage, rotten, terrible things we do to one another, are in fact because we recognize the humanity of the other person. I think a lot of cruelty is born out of a normal and natural appreciation of the humanity of others, which then connects with certain important psychological appetites we have, like an appetite to punish those we think have done wrong. Most cruelty, he argues, happens because we do recognize the humanity of the other person. And so humanity's addiction to cruelty is much deeper than just not appreciating that someone else is fully human. So often we're cruel because we see other humans as threats. Threats to our control, a competitor for sex, money, power, prestige. Cruelty is born in thinking others are cruel themselves and we want to punish them, or thinking other humans have erred and they need to be corrected. Cruelty is born out of a desire for justice. It's born out of seeing, hey, wait, they got more than me, or they have deprived me. We're just doing what needs to be done. Sometimes cruelty is born out of pragmatics, and so we treat people horribly because we see them as moral human beings in need of correction, even if that correction is cruel. And it's interesting to me because you kind of see this play out in the crucifixion landscape. I don't think the characters around the cross saw themselves as being cruel. I don't think they looked at Jesus as less than human. In fact, I think they saw Jesus as fully human and realized the potential threat he was. And whether it was the religious leaders or Roman guards, they were men who thought of themselves as doing justice, doing what needed to be done in order to get rid of a problem and a threat. We're simply doing what needs to be done to protect a way of life. They're dealing with a problem. That is not dehumanization. That is seeing someone as fully human and believing they deserve cruelty because they're a threat. And I think that is where most of our cruel acts or even intentions come from. I've been interested, I think, as we all have in some ways, about the rise of white supremacy and nationalism that we see taking place like all over the world. And one of the things that I have found fascinating about this uprising movement is the language and rhetoric of those movements today. Think about the slogan of those who marched in Charlottesville back in 2017. Their banner slogan was this: "You will not replace us." That's interesting to me because that's not the slogan of people who think they are protesting others who are less than human. That's the language of people who are scared that they're going to be replaced. That's the language of people who see other people as a threat. And so I think they see some people as a threat to status, a way of life, and truth be told, we all do, to one extent or another, see others that way. Or consider, this is fascinating, the philosopher Kate Mann in her book, Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, she says this: often it's not a sense of woman's humanity that is lacking, her humanity is precisely the problem. And in her book, it's interesting, she explores the case of Elliot Rodger. I don't know if you remember this. Back in 2014, he went on a killing spree in California, killed six, injured about a dozen others. What was chilling is he left behind a videotape explaining what he was doing. And in his videotape, he launches a tirade against women. And he says this: "You gave your affection and sex and love to other men, but never to me. I'll punish you all for it." And what Kate Mann points out in her book is that this wasn't the case of objectification or dehumanization. No, it was a warped anger because these women's human capacity for love and romance had excluded him. And in his warped logic, he had been done an injustice. He had been excluded. And I think therein lies the roots of cruelty. Whenever we're threatened, or wronged, or hurt, our appetite for cruelty kicks in. And let's be honest, cruelty is not relegated to fringe people or movements. They give us extreme examples, but they also point to something that's in all of us. All of us have, or will, end up feeling threatened, hurt, wronged. And in that, the seeds of cruelty are sown. Because as humans, I think we understand the complexity of other people. And so we know that people can inspire us. We know that we can admire other people. But people can also make us afraid and resentful. People can be friends. They can be lovers. They can be our partners. They can also be rivals, enemies. That's true for all of us. Mann concludes by saying this: "Moreover, in being capable of rationality, agency, autonomy, and judgment, they," another human, "are also someone who could coerce, manipulate, humiliate, or shame you. In being capable of abstract relational thought and congruent moral emotions, they're capable of thinking ill of you and regarding you contemptuously. In being capable of forming complex desires and intentions, they are capable of harboring malice and plotting against you. In being capable of valuing, they may value what you abhor and abhor what you value. They may hence be a threat to all that you cherish." And the reality of human cruelty is a tough pill to swallow. The reality of human cruelty forces us to wrestle with the tension so often. Both our best and our worst tendencies come from seeing other people as human. As people, we can choose to be cruel. And sometimes our choices to be cruel are enacted, unfortunately, on those we love most, right? The issue for many of us is that we have bought into the lie that cruelty is the best weapon we have for dealing with threats. And so John is trying to marry these stories in our mind. I love the image of what the gospel writers are doing, are trying to put portraits, paintings on the walls of our minds, and so he's wanting to hang up these stories together. What John is trying to do here is remind us of the kindness Jesus showed with water and wine, as opposed to the cruelty he was given with water and wine. And so it's like John is calling, whispering to us in this story. When you think of Jesus being denied water and given sour wine, think also of Jesus giving a couple the best wine. Now you make a choice. What do you want to give in this particular situation, the sour wine of human cruelty or the fine wine of kindness? When you think of Jesus being given vinegar on the cross, think also of him giving living water that healed the woman and her community. Now you make a choice. What do you want to do in this situation, the vinegar of human cruelty or the living water of kindness and healing? And John is hanging those portraits in our mind, reminding us we have a choice. We always have a choice. Sour wine of human cruelty or the fine wine of human kindness. It's a choice we're faced with day after day, situation by situation. And I'm reminded, of course, of Dumbledore in Harry Potter, bringing full circle, who says to Harry, "It is our choices, Harry, that show who we really are far more than our abilities." And so we all have those choices. We can be cruel with ourselves, or we can replace that with kindness. One of the things that I've encountered so often in pastoral ministry is a deep realization how many people are incredibly cruel with themselves. And their heads are filled with voices that constantly berate them, mock them, put them down. And it's interesting because sometimes in the voices in our heads, it gets confusing. What is from God? What is my conscience? Let's say any voice in our head that isn't kind isn't from God. Even if it is a corrective kindness, but still, some of us are incredibly cruel with ourselves. There's a choice we can make. We can replace those voices, the cruelty we place on ourselves, with kindness. So be gentle with yourselves. Don't give yourself the sour wine of human cruelty. Give yourself the fine wine of human kindness. Or cruelty with our loved ones. It's interesting to me how I think our loved ones so often get the worst of us, right? It's often our loved ones that we're most cruel with. Little things. I was upset at Kristen this week and I was giving her the silent treatment. It's so stupid, but it's also very human. Was upset, and every time she asked me something, what's going on? Fine. Because the sour wine I gave her was this: you figure out what's wrong, all right? You take that and try to figure out what's wrong. And so often with our kids, our friends, our parents, our loved ones, we're the most cruel with them because we feel safe, but even still, we have a choice to give our loved ones the sour wine of human cruelty or the fine wine of human kindness. Or even with our enemies, it's so hard in such a polarized world to not lash out in cruelty as people we see as our enemies, whether that's physical, whether it's friends who we feel competitive with, whether it's ideological enemies, whatever it is, kindness is so lacking these days, but we have a choice. Sour wine of human cruelty, the fine wine of human kindness. As humans, we're addicted to cruelty because we believe the lie that cruelty is the best weapon we have for dealing with threats. And sometimes that threat is internal. Sometimes it's our ego. Sometimes it's threats to our power, our influence, our values, our ideas, our convictions, our beliefs. Whether we're threatened by inner voices in our heads or the careless word of a friend, doesn't matter. Whatever the threat, cruelty often presents itself as the answer. And what John wants us to do is say, look at these stories. Who do you want to be? Who do you want to be? You want to be the one giving out sour wine or the one giving out living water of kindness? I'm going to ask the band to just play us out in a second here. But again, we have a choice. And I think the cross brings us there, cruelty or kindness. And so I hope as we journey again towards Easter that this story stays with you in some way. Add it to the collection of art you're putting up in your mind. Think on it. Contemplate on it. I hope that when you think about Jesus being denied water and given sour wine, you also think of him giving out the best wine. Not just good wine, the best wine of human kindness. I hope that when you think about Jesus being given vinegar, you also think of him giving out the living water of restored relationships. And that in turn, no matter the circumstance or how hard or how tempted you are to cruelty, you will choose to give the living water, the fine wine. John is hanging these portraits on our mind, reminding us we have a choice. Sour wine of human cruelty or the fine wine of human kindness. May God's Holy Spirit guide us and prompt us to make the right choices. Go in peace.